want to hand it off to our executive director, Angela Jamont, to start the introductions.
Well, thank you again for this opportunity to focus on our goal, our theme for this year, and this topic of case law within Title III within California and how it impacts and reflects within California CCDA. And so as I shared this morning, we're just beginning this discussion. And so we really wanted it to be more of a casual conversation, an introduction to CCDA board, as well as other stakeholders coming together on this topic. And so we're so pleased that we had such a great response to this discussion. And the way we have the day set up is that we have a moderator, and that is none other than our past chair, Guy Lemus. And we have introducing the roundtable discussion is our judge, Joseph Sapero. And so I'd like to begin first by introducing our moderator, and then our moderator will introduce our first guest speaker. And from there, he will lead the following the roundtable discussion. And so many of you are familiar with our past immediate chair as our previous chair of our commission for several years. But I wanted to share with you a little bit more about his private side, and that is his public practice within the state of California. And that is Guy Lemus has been an attorney in private practice in Culver City with the areas of focus of special education, disability rights, family law, and probation matters. He primarily litigates family law and probate matters in the Central District of Los Angeles County Superior Court. He has been appointed minor counsel in various departments in the Central District Family Law.
I'm on. I'm looking for you.
I'm on.
We also have, and he will also then introduce to you our guest speaker from the United States District Court, Northern District of California. So without further ado, I'd like for you all to welcome this roundtable, our moderator, Commissioner Guy Lemus.
Thank you, Angela. Good to be with everyone this morning. It's my distinct honor to introduce the Honorable Joseph C. Sparrow, who is the Chief Magistrate Judge for the United States District Court for the Northern District of California. He's been a magistrate for 21 years and is chief for the past 5 years. Judge Sparrow has presided as trial judge in criminal and civil cases in a variety of subject areas, including patent, employment, civil rights, including disability rights, commercial contract, trademark, and federal misdemeanor cases. He has also served as a settlement judge in over 1,500 cases. A 1981 graduate of Columbia University School of Law, he clerked for the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. He worked as an associate at Skadden, Arps, Slate, Magrin, Plum, and as associate then partner at Koblenz, Pahun, McCabe, and Breyer, now Koblenz, Patch, Duffy, and Vase. Judge Sparrow is going to begin our discussion, disability access and public accommodation cases in California. Please welcome Judge Sparrow to the California Commission on Disability Access. Judge Sparrow.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Lemus. Thank you to the commissioners for allowing me to talk and participate in this roundtable. Thank you to Ms. Jamont for guiding me through the process of getting here. I appreciate the excellent work. I can hopefully add a small amount of information to the information that your staff can get to you, that the other individuals on the roundtable can get you, and that is the experience in the federal court for Northern California. Our district extends along the coast from Monterey to the Oregon border and includes all of the San Francisco Bay Area counties. Our experience with ADA access cases is probably not dissimilar from most people's experience with ADA access cases, and that is they all resolve. But delays in that resolution have tremendous consequences. First, of course, they have the consequence of a delay in the implementation of whatever the access barrier elimination that the parties agree to. But also important is the fact that if there is a delay in the settlement, attorney's fees are incurred, and that increases the cost of the settlement by increasing the attorney's fees involved, both in the sense of defendant may be required to pay their attorney for litigation activities, and it may be part of the settlement in the end that the defendant is required to pay to the plaintiff. So it increases the cost of compliance. And what frustrated us for many years at the beginning of my tenure was how do we try to cut down on that sort of problem? That is to say, have the settlements come sooner and have them not burdened by the unnecessary litigation expenses. And so we came up with a process which is instructive in some ways, I suppose, that I've been invited to talk to you about. And that is, we came up with a general order applicable to all Title III cases, which focus on resolution immediately upon the filing of the case. And we do that in a number of ways. And the first way we do it is by stopping the litigation. The first part of the general order stays the litigation so that no one is wasting their time on unnecessary litigation tasks. Now, I should say that that stay can be lifted and is in particular cases where it is necessary to do some litigation tasks, but in the vast majority of cases, in the overwhelming majority of cases, that remains in place. And then second, the parties are directed, they're ordered within 60 days of the complaint being served, so right away, to do a joint site inspection. They have to actually go physically to the site. Obviously, there have been various difficulties with that in the past year, but in general, they go physically to the site. Lawyers must attend, and someone from each party who has authority to make decisions, including on settlement, has to attend. And at the site inspection, they get the information that is similar to the information required in the stateside demand letters. Plaintiff has to identify the barriers. Plaintiff has to identify the proposed corrective actions. The defendant has to indicate what they think of the barriers and proposed corrective actions and what they're willing to do. If the defendant has a view that it's not something that's required by the disability rules because it's not reasonably readily achievable, the defendant has to give information about that. Often the parties actually bring their experts, not necessarily disability access specialists certified, but certainly the experts they would be relying on in the case, to those inspections. And the hope is that if we get everybody together right away and actually focus on what the barriers are and what people will do, we can get this resolved more quickly. And then within the next 35 days after the site inspection, they have to have a settlement meeting. It's not with a judge or a mediator. They just have to have a settlement meeting where parties attend and the lawyers attend. A plaintiff has to make appropriate demands, starting first with the fix, and ultimately, if the fix is agreed upon, with some monetary demands, the defendant has to respond after that. So the whole focus for the first 90 days is entirely on settlement. When I say entirely on settlement, it's not conduct that will be not without value if they proceed to litigation. They may have experts out there. They'll have seen the site. They'll know what the issues in the case are. But the hope is that what they really are trying to do is settle the case. And then they have to try to settle the case. And if they don't, then they get referred to a mediation. So someone else will help them settle the case. Only after they've gone through all those steps, and that's about the first, I would say, 130, 140 days of the litigation, can they actually start to incur attorney's fees in litigating. They can ask the court to come to court for a case management conference. And the hope is that this process would encourage settlement without unnecessary litigation activities. And I can tell you, as a person who was here before the general order came into effect, and after the general order came into effect, the impact is quite dramatic. When I was first a magistrate judge, and for the first probably 10 years, when we didn't have a general order, the parties would do it all at the same time. They would be litigating, they would be taking depositions, they would bring motions to the court, all while they're trying to theoretically settle the case in some fashion. And so they spent a great deal of money, and the attorney's fees were quite significant, litigating in court. And we would see them a lot, see them in a case management, see them on motions. Since the general order has come into place, we almost never see one person. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, but the cases settle before they get to a judge for resolution of anything substantive. And that's because we're forcing the parties to focus on that first and try to figure out whether there can be a settlement. And because I think we're saving money for the parties by not having litigation go on simultaneously. The nearly all cases settle without the need for a case management conference. Can I use the share screen, Ms. Gemma? Am I allowed to do that?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to show you a little chart. It's just a brief chart that shows some of the filings. Let's see, where is it? There it is. Can you all see that?
Yes.
So this is a chart of the filings in the Northern District of California for the last 5 years. And you can see certainly in the last few years, we've been hovering between 800 and 900 cases per year. This year, the first few months, there was a huge number that were filed. I'm not quite sure why that is, but there's been about 800 already this year. So we're expecting to have an increase this year, although that 1999 is probably a little bit high. But in any event, you can see that we've been getting more and more over time, and that. But the interesting thing about this is that. In each of the last few years, you can see about 50% of the cases were referred to a mediation or settlement conferences. Those are the two lines. The blue line is the total, and the orange line is mediation, and the gray line is settlement conferences before magistrate judges. So about 50% of them did not have to be referred to mediation. They went through the process, the parties settled themselves. The remainder, all that went to a mediation or a settlement judge, magistrate judge. And as I said, all those virtually all settled. There were, each year there are a few that end up being decided by the court on motion. And every 4 or 5 years we get a trial. But other than that, very little litigation activity in any of these cases. And our thinking and our hope is that this was a result of, at least comparing now to before the general orders, that having the parties focus on the mediation, focus on settlement, focus on the site visit and their discussions before they do litigation has had beneficial effects. It's resulted in a typical ADA case having very little in the way of litigation activity. As I said, there are always exceptions. There are cases where there are unsettled issues of law that the parties really have to litigate and probably litigate in any number of cases before they're going to be able to make much headway. And there may be individual cases where the parties are so dramatically differing in their views of what the regulations and the statutes require that they have to litigate for a while. Those are always painful to me because I know that after, you know, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 in attorney's fees, we're going to turn back to settlement with the additional burden of having to deal with $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 worth of attorney's fees. So it's unfortunate what happens. But as I say, it's mostly not, mostly by forcing the parties. It's interesting, this is one of the topics that this roundtable addresses, compliance with the statutes, and I might share a little bit of our experience with that. General order requires the parties to do any number of things. And when they do it, they have to certify to the court that it's been done, sort of like the reports that they file with you all. And those compliance with those requirements has been, I would say, spotty. We're working on that more now, trying to make sure that everybody gets into compliance eventually. But we've had to take more actions than we would like to make sure that people actually had the site visit, actually did have a settlement conference. There were people there that actually could make decisions about it, et cetera, et cetera. So, and one of the ways we've done that is to get the magistrate judges more involved in the compliance efforts to make sure that parties take the general order quite seriously. So that's in a nutshell, how our process works. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, or if you have any questions about anything with respect to ADA access filings or cases in federal court, or anything else that you might have. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Judge Sparrow, for that illuminating introduction. And I think it sets the stage for us to have a pretty hearty conversation with our additional guests that we have with us, a number of people from the legal community on both sides of the table, so to speak, who either represent plaintiffs, meaning people with disabilities with violation access issues, or those defending the businesses that may be accused of having ADA access violations. And so we kind of worked up there a number of questions, and I wanted to just remind people that as the legal folks that we've invited chime in this discussion, please be mindful of your time, meaning try not to speak in long snippets, but try to take one or two kind of basic comments so we can have a robust conversation without anybody taking over the conversation. I know that's hard for us to do as attorneys, but I know we can do it today. And if not, Judge Sparrow and I will help you. Please say your name each time before you speak so people know who is speaking. And we want to make sure we hear from both sides as well. So we'll be listening to that. But here's a few of the questions that are out there. And I want you to just to kind of think about them, legal eagles. For the plaintiff's bar, the plaintiff's attorneys, what are your current experiences in filing Title III disability access cases in the state of California? That's one thing to share. Where do you normally file between the state or federal courts? Why? What are the district challenges or opportunities between two court systems in filing these cases? For the defense attorney, what have been your most common interactions defending clients of Title III disability access cases or pre-litigation letters? What are the differences in defending cases in state and federal court? And then finally, a question that you both can consider to both defense and plaintiff counsel. In 2009, SB 1608 defined the appropriate communications within a pre-litigation letter. Then in 2013, within SB 1186, required all pre-litigation letters to be sent to both CCDA and to the state bar. The state bar has had the responsibility of reporting annually the numbers of letters they received and numbers of letters received that were investigated, the potential violation of civil codes 55.31 or 55.32. And what are your thoughts on the so few numbers reported of suspected violations reported by the bar. Are you surprised? There's more questions I can ask, but I think that if I ask any more, you're going to forget what I asked. So why don't we start with that, and I will leave it to you to enter into the conversation, starting with the plaintiff's counsel attorneys.
I'll enter into the conversation. This is Anthony Goldsmith. I'm a partner at Kirby McGinnis and Goldsmith, and I had the pleasure of being on stakeholders committees for both of the pieces of legislation that were just discussed. And I believe that the reason the state bar is reporting so few violations with respect to the letter writing requirement, one, it's pretty basic. And secondly, the requirement to report, the requirement to submit one's demand letter to the state bar unquestionably has had a chilling effect on using letters to try to solve cases. And I recall from being involved at the time that the driving issue were people being plastered with these money demand of letters. And people would literally go by and stick one on somebody's window or shove it under the door. And I think that is a valid concern. But I do believe that the way it has worked out has caught a lot of dolphins in the tuna net. And I know in our firm, where we have any number of cases that are not just straight out access cases, they involve a crossover to a personal injury. It's made it difficult for us to open a matter with a demand letter. And I might be interested in knowing other people's experience, both from defense and plaintiff on that.
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry, we've neglected to introduce the guest, and I don't have the list in front of me, so I'm going to have Angela do that. So as we continue the discussion, let's briefly, I'm so sorry, acknowledge the attorneys we do have with us. Angela?
Yes, apologize to you, Commissioner Lemus, for not putting the list in your notes. We have confirmed All Access Law Group. Would All Access Law Group, anyone from that group, could you acknowledge your presence?
Yes, Irakli Karmelashvili for All Access Law Group.
Excellent. And then we also have already heard from Goldsmith and McGinnis. Thank you. And Derby, McGinnis, and Goldsmith.
And regarding that, Ms. Jamont, Celia McGinnis, I'm also present.
Thank you, Ms. McGinnis. So good to see you. She is a previous commissioner for those of you who do not know. So we're excited. We get excited seeing her. Next, California Justice Alliance, David Peters.
Hello, thanks for the opportunity.
Golden Law, Raquel Golden. Blake Law, Vaughn and Associates, Chris Vaughn.
Yes, thank you. Present.
Thank you. Christina Laundrie.
I'm here. Hello.
And then we have from Moore Law Firm.
Yes, good afternoon, everyone.
We have Strojanic Law Firm.
Peter Strojanic, how are you?
Thank you. Disability Rights of California, Zinette Hassan.
Hello.
And then lastly, confirmed SZ Engineering Access Incorporated.
This is Sarun Snosian. Actually, we're not a law firm. We provide ADA access consulting services, but we do work quite a bit in with clients involved in litigation.
Thank you so much. Those are the confirmations we have. Are there anyone that I did not name that were invited that I did not have the name for. I would love to have you acknowledge your presence for the record.
Yes, I don't know if our firm was actually invited. I just received the link. My name is Dennis Price, and I'm here from Potter Handy.
Thank you. Anyone else? And again, we just acknowledge that this is an informal roundtable. So we've named some of you all. You're welcome to share as you are encouraged to do so. This is a very informal roundtable discussion, and we really are interested in hearing your thoughts and concerns or opinions. So from there, moderator, Commissioner Lemus, back to you.
Okay, hold on.
Hi, this is Peter Stroinik. I'm not sure if I can go now, but I'd like to address a concern if I could, please.
Sure, go right ahead.
One of the concerns that I have is on the case resolution report form. For example, there is, and I never know how to answer this question. So the bar has come a call in to me on settled cases. And as part of the CCR or CRR report form, there is a matter of resolution, settlement, judgment, or dismissal. Sometimes, well, all the time, after a settlement, the case is dismissed. And the bar would say to me, Mr. Stroinik, the case was dismissed, it wasn't settled. And I say, well, it was dismissed pursuant to settlement, and then they understand, and then they go away. My question to the commission would be, generally, in any settlement, there's a dismissal after settlement. Do you folks want us to say on the reporting form, settlement and dismissal, or what is it that you want there? And number two, what is the date of settlement? I could call Joe Johnson of Joe Johnson Law Firm, and we have a talk, and we settle in principle between two lawyers. The next step after that is I send an agreement or he sends me an agreement. The next step after that is we redline it. The step after that is the parties sign it. At what date does the settlement occur according to the commission? Because as part of our requirement, we have to report the resolution within 5 days. And is it the day that Mr. Johnson and I say, we got a deal? Or is it the day that the parties sign the settlement agreement? Because in federal court, for example, a notice of settlement, my understanding is the notice of settlement needs to be filed on the day the party's lawyers say we have a deal. But I don't know what the commission requires. So some guidance on that would be appreciated. With that, if there's anyone who has any answers, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, well, why don't we parking lot that one for a minute, because that's really gets it to nuts and bolts. We'll get an answer for you for that question. But I think what we're trying to do here is just kind of give people who are listening and the commissioner members kind of your experience as attorneys dealing with these types of cases. We will, so let's parking lot that issue, because that gets into how we want the form to be answered. I can tell you the short answer is, we're looking for more quantitative information as well, more qualitative information, not just quantitative. And one of the things that's difficult is we see a lot of numbers, but we don't necessarily know how it was settled, what happened, was it made accessible, how did things end? So we get a lot of front end information, and if something settled, that's all we know. We don't really know what was the issue. Was there an accessibility issue that it got addressed, or was it really not an accessibility issue? So there's still, I think, questions that we're hoping that we can find out more information, because as I think you can all appreciate, there are narratives with respect to this issue of the filing of lawsuits on behalf of people with disabilities. Some say there's too many being filed. Some say there's not enough being filed. And the question is, we have to look at some of the data to begin to understand how is it, can we move forward as a state to ensure that we don't have to result in litigation and have accessibility, but knowing that this is one of the sole ways people can get access issues addressed. So with that, Dave, have we heard anybody from Defense Counsel yet? Do you want to share a little bit about from your perspective, what is it like doing these types of cases from your perspective?
This is Chris Vaughn. I can weigh in a little bit.
Thank you.
In trying to respond to the subjects that you identified with regard to pre-litigation letters, the environment has certainly changed. I think that the primary pre-litigation letters we see now are having to do with website accessibility much more than physical barrier type circumstances. The other thing that we're seeing more of with regard to pre-litigation letters is numerous letters coming from out-of-state lawyers and or out-of-state plaintiffs. And so it creates some questions about how a plaintiff in Philadelphia or in Tampa, how that all impacts our litigation environment in California. In terms of defending state and federal cases, there's a difference procedurally that sometimes is a little more complicated in state court because you have 58 counties and in our experience about 58 different approaches to implementing the stay and early evaluation provisions of the statute. In federal courts, we have, of course, the four federal districts and all have their own approaches to efforts to resolve cases early. The Northern District has a working system. I do think that the Central District has a system that works much more quickly. Probably the overwhelming majority of judges, but not all, will, upon application from a defendant, issue a stay and mandatory mediation conference to be completed within 90 days. In our experience, that short time and the fact that active and substantive participation is expected at that mediation conference accomplishes a lot of the same results, in my experience at least, as the Northern District process under the general order does. It's about 5 to 6 or 7 months faster. And I think, in our experience, has accomplished much the same results in early resolution, early evaluation. There's not a site inspection, which is one of the mandatory requirements that Judge Sparrow reviewed, but I think from a defense standpoint, recognizing the need to either complete alterations or negotiate a time for completion of alterations handles the injunctive relief or the what physical changes or what barriers will be remedied part of the case. And I think it probably would, in my experience, suggest that the resolution of those cases ends up being less total money paid by the defendant, which may be a reflection of the shortened time within which those cases can be addressed and resolved. So those would be my observations. Thank you.
Thank you. That was very helpful in terms of kind of the dynamics, in terms of what processes may work a little bit better. And it's kind of interesting too, from hearing you from a defense attorney standpoint, which may be different than what we hear from your client. And so it's almost like, and once we put this in the legal context, there's a legal problem that needs to be resolved and you're focused on it. And so it's much more further. One of the things that we don't have a question on specifically, but I want to raise, I'm curious to hear both sides, is that one of the things that continues to be, I think, the area of controversy and how we discuss these issues is, you know, the story is that there are some individuals who are using a person, a name only, to go and file multiple lawsuits, who have never been to the site, but someone drives by the site and can see some access violations from the outside of the building and therefore files a lawsuit. And I'd be interested to hear from both of your perspectives, because everybody has heard this. And the question becomes, you know, there is a law, there are plaintiffs. What is your perspective, plaintiff's counsel, on who should file lawsuits? And do you think there's any problem with someone filing multiple lawsuits in a particular community where they may not reside or where they may not have actually visited the facility? In other words, I guess what I'm saying in essence is it enough to see that there are actually ADA violations and they could take it upon themselves, almost like a private attorney general, to move forward in a private action? Or should they be an injured party in some way, have attempted to try to access that building and could not? Let's hear from plaintiff's counsel first. And, what's your perspective on that?
This is Celia McGinnis, partner at Derby McGinnis and Goldsmith, former member of this commission, also a mediator on the Northern District panel. So I mediate these cases. My perspective on that, and I really appreciate the question, and I think your question contains the answer, Mr. Loomis, because you said, should plaintiffs be private attorneys general? And the answer to that question is, plaintiffs are private attorneys general. The statute is set up so that these laws are enforced not by a building department or a government entity, but by the individuals who are either harmed or at risk of being harmed by the violations. Which private attorney general statutes are time-honored and frequently used method of ensuring compliance with the law without adding layers of government bureaucracy. And going back to at least the 60s, if not before. So my answer to your question is absolutely anybody who is a person with a disability or a person who is affiliated with a person with a disability who sees a violation should be able to raise it. There become two questions, and one is, and these are legal questions really, one is a standing question. Does a person who has encountered a barrier or could encounter a barrier have the right to bring a lawsuit? That is a legal question that's decided in the federal court or the state court, wherever it's brought. But so far, the Ninth Circuit at least has determined that a person who either encounters a barrier or is deterred because they are aware of a barrier, they can't go to a place, both of those categories of people have standing or the right to bring a lawsuit. The reason for that broad standing is to make sure, A, that the policy behind the Americans with Disabilities Act and state laws are honored. The purpose here is to have full and equal access for people with disabilities, and having a broad definition of who can bring a lawsuit fosters that policy. The second reason is that bringing a lawsuit because of deterrence also creates certain efficiencies in most cases. You don't have to bring an individual lawsuit every time you go to a place and encounter a different barrier. The second piece, though, and this is implicated not under federal law because there are no damages allowed under the Americans with Disabilities Act, but under state law that does provide for damages, the legislature has determined that in order to qualify for damages, a person either has to have actually encountered a barrier and experienced difficulty, embarrassment, or discomfort as a result, or they have to be deterred from having gone to the facility because of their actual knowledge of a barrier. So the framework is already there for a person to be precluded from getting damages if they don't meet those requirements. They still have the right to seek an injunction, which furthers a public policy, but there are some limitations on who can get damages. You've asked the question, so I'll answer it. I personally think that many people should be bringing these lawsuits because it is the only way that this law is enforced. So I am absolutely opposed to any lawsuit that is frivolous. That is a lawsuit that is brought without a firm ethical foundation or firm and reasonable belief that there is a barrier. But if there is a barrier and a person brings a lawsuit, that lawsuit is not, as a legal question, frivolous.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, former Commissioner Celia. Appreciate that. And in full disclosure, I'm also a plaintiff's counsel, so I want to give fair room for a person from the defense side to see if they share your perspective and of the law and perhaps mine. Would someone from the defense side like to weigh in about that? And what are your thoughts about, are there some cases that you think run afoul of what the statute says? And if so, what are they? And how do you contend with what Ms. McGinnis just said? Because that seems to be an area where we have cross points.
This is Chris Vaughn.
Thank you. Proceed.
I think that the description that Celia gave is accurate. I don't think there's any question that the law is enforced by private lawsuits. I don't think there's any question that it's an important right, a civil right. At the same time, the question occurs to me when California is estimated to have somewhere between 12 and 18% of the disabled population in the United States and is rapidly approaching 50% of all ADA lawsuits filed nationwide, is there an issue? There's no question that the courts in virtually all the districts in California have essentially ruled something like this, that a plaintiff can sue as many properties as they wish if those properties have barriers to access, which I think is the correct approach. The question becomes, when a person lives 100 to 300 or 400 miles away and sue 5, 50, 100 properties that far from their home, are they genuinely there and discriminated against that number of times, or is there some other motive or agenda? And so I think the question really is the application of the law, and of course from a defense standpoint, the belief at some level is that the cases are motivated in certain circumstances, certainly not all, by an economic motive rather than some other motive. And I do think that certainly there is, at least from the standpoint of defendants, a perception that the motive is other than to acquire disabled access. I don't personally necessarily subscribe to that, but I do think it creates a question in the mind of the public of whether or not the motivation is purely so that I, as a disabled person, can go to the property versus some other motive. And I'm very sensitive to the need for this kind of litigation. Part of that sensitivity is based upon two things: my wife being disabled, and secondly, I travel throughout the Northwest and Western states a fair amount, and there is little, if any, compliance in other states in the Western part of the United States with the ADA disabled access requirements as compared to California. So you have, I think, I'd kind of describe it as some maybe competing interests in terms of having access improvements made versus the perception on the part of the public, and especially business owners and small business owners who are frequently the targets in some of these lawsuits, that there's an agenda other than personal access being provided. So that would be kind of the perspective that I would suggest exists from the defendant standpoint of the businesses they're sued.
Thank you. I wanted to just follow up with that. Given what Celia had shared and what you agreed with, but I hear you carving out a particular issue that I think may be driving some of the issue, which is, you know, it seems like there's a higher propensity of lawsuits in California. We could say that about all lawsuits. California is a very litigious state. We all know that. But the issue that I think you're hitting on that I want to tease out with you a little bit more, I'd be interested to hear a little follow-up, if you don't mind, is so let's say the folks who are 300 miles away are doing it because they just want it to be accessible and they don't necessarily have damages, then how do we determine that the motivation is a financial one? Or is that the assumption we're making simply because of proximity? So I live in California. I like to go to San Francisco every once in a while, and then Monterey, and there are places I like to go. If I know that the places where I go, which may be only once a year, are inaccessible, and I take the time to file something because it doesn't seem to be accessible, is that financially motivated, or is that simply an issue around you know, someone wanting to be able to travel in other parts of the state? How do you kind of parse that issue?
I really don't, but I do think there's a difference objectively from the scenario you described, and it's a case by case analysis. The court is the one that's the arbiter of standing and those kind of things. But your fact pattern, I think, is consistent with an individual wanting to gain access for themselves or their family member or whoever. Contrast that with the plaintiff that goes to Monterey once a year and files 300 lawsuits for businesses within Monterey County. And I don't know the answer, and I don't, you know, in my job, I don't have to know the answer, but those are two different factual scenarios and two different impacts of the law that I think may need to be considered because it, and I can tell you the courts have without any difficulty in the fact pattern that you've provided found that they're standing and that case moves forward. I don't know that there's a distinction in terms of entitlement to economic damages, and I don't believe there is any distinction between an individual who files one lawsuit or two lawsuits or three lawsuits for their own personal access and the person that files 300 lawsuits. So it's a question that I don't know the answer to, but it causes concern for defendants, you know, based upon the percentage of disabled persons in California versus the disabled of nationwide lawsuits that are filed here.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you working through that. They're not easy issues. Were there some people who had their hands up that wanted to raise? Staff, you have a screen on that just shows me a document. I can't see people. So
Guy,
raise their hand. You're going to have to do that.
Guy, this is. Yeah. Guy, this is. Guy, this is Kurt Kuchnick, Deputy State Architect, Division of the State Architect.
Go ahead,
I have a really naive question for all of the attorneys. Before I came to DSA, when I was a lobbyist for the American Institute of Architects, I worked on SB 262 and SB 1186. And I've always wondered why we not expend energy in the area of what is the object of the transaction here. To me, it should have always been correcting the violation, not enriching someone through UNRU. So for the person who travels to Monterey from any distance and files multiple lawsuits, why does that have to be an enrichment? Why can't that just be thank you for making us aware of this, and the limitations of this are in fact that we will correct the violations. Don't want to get into safe harbor or any of that, but it's always, and I brought it up before in those discussions on the legislation, why do we never pursue this as an alternative? Why not, if there is to be a settlement, it go to an escrow account to correct the violation? Why does it have to be someone's payday? Anybody?
Well, Kurt, this is Anthony Goldsmith again. You and I worked on those same panels together. Please take this with the sincerity with which it is intended. These are violations of California civil rights, and those have consequences. And the history of our civil rights law, our civil rights laws, was designed to use a penalty or penalties as a means of prompting people proactively to do the things they need to do, as well as recognizing that there is an actual harm, a harm in fact, to these persons. And it is true that, and I think Mr. Vaughn pointed this out, about compliance in other states where we don't have a statutory framework like this at all. And I've had not the same experience Mr. Vaughn had. I know that Mr. Vaughn is a CASP as well as an attorney, understands this area very well. For years, I was a partner in a national access consulting firm, and we literally surveyed facilities in all 50 states. And Mr. Vaughn is correct. When you get outside of California border, the level of compliance begins to, with a couple of exceptions, begins to fall apart. And in many states, there's just no enforcement whatsoever. The framework that we created in California through legislative action of trying to limit damages to specific circumstances, whether that's foul or fair in anyone's opinion, is part and parcel of our state's recognition that there is a harm, as well as needing to be an incentive. And so I think that's the answer to that. It's a philosophical question about how you should accomplish, how you can get the most access with and cause the least harm to the disability community and individuals. But I think you would find that most people on the disability rights side of this don't consider this any kind of an unfair enrichment or a payday. And those terms kind of carry a lot of weight with them, but I don't really think they're applicable to the way we view civil rights in California in general, or specifically with respect to the enforcement of these laws.
Well, don't misunderstand my words. We're talking about serial litigants here, right?
Well, are we? I mean, I didn't hear the distinction.
Well, I believe there are those who are out there to do good, and I believe those. We know there are those out there to enrich themselves. You know, they don't care if the violation is corrected. They may even prefer it's not, so they can return once again to file again. But I'm just asking the question. You know, to me, the most reasonable thing after resolving someone's civil rights violation is making sure that the violation is corrected. And how do we do that? I haven't really heard much about that.
Well, I think that Judge Sparrow pointed out the mechanism of GO 56. I have wished for years and suggested that GO 56 is an ideal model for the resolution of litigation and should be adopted both at the state level and in other districts. But that's how we do it. I guess I may have failed to understand whether you were questioning the concept of why we have damages in California, and is that equitable, and does it promote access? I think the proof is in pudding. The answer is definitely yes, it promotes access. I would want to move the question down a different fork of the road, which is how could it be after all these years and these laws, which are effective at promoting more access than in other states, that we still have situations where I can, in my own community, drive around, find barriers everywhere that could have been competently corrected by any, frankly, licensed contractor, paving, general, or painting, in parking lots and in exterior routes, which would, so that sort of baffles me still to this day. And so the question to me isn't, what are we doing wrong so that the result is that we have more litigation in California than other states? The question is, what are we doing wrong that we haven't created enough of an incentive to eliminate patent barriers? We've done a lot. We've put in the CASP program. We've incentivized people to use CASPs. We have a system of damages available for people with disabilities. We obviously don't discourage good faith litigation. We've then gone and tried to limit those to people who are deterred or actually agree. And yet, you know, seeing this from both sides, as a plaintiff's lawyer and as a former consultant who mostly worked on the defense side, I am still in shock that I can drive somewhere and see a striped parking space with a 12% slope. I would say that in dealing with this, where I'd like to see the conversation moved is, what can the state of California do to encourage greater proactivity on the part of people who own commercial properties, where there are public accommodations and otherwise, and the operators of those public accommodations, to come into compliance? So I see the problem in a different light, I guess.
So let's put that question on a parking lot. I want to ask a different question, then we'll return to that question because I think it's a good question, Anthony. And I know Celia had her hand up to want to get in. But I also want to, in the context of CCDA, we get primarily the state complaints. And one of the things we're trying to understand is, and it may have already been answered, but want to give people an opportunity, why does there seem to be a trend to file in federal court versus state court? What's wrong with the state court system? Why aren't more, given that the damages come with the state law, why does it appear that more things are being filed in federal court than state court? What are people's thoughts on that? And Celia, you can go first, but if you could maybe address that a little bit, that's one of our questions we wanted to get an answer to.
Well, thank you. I don't know the answer, but I can surmise. We mostly file in federal court for the following reasons. Most of our practice, although not all, is in the Northern District, and we think that General Order 56 is a terrific and efficient system. I mean, there's some tweaks that I would, you know, always propose, but overall, I think it's an excellent system, and I think it's effective. And we think that the judges pay close attention, close and fair attention to the issues in these cases. And we just prefer to practice in federal court. That's why we bring them there. The procedures that were implemented over the last 5 years with the early evaluations, it's possible those are having some sort of an impact and causing some people to switch from state court to federal court. But to be honest, I have never yet had a case where the defendant actually had followed those procedures and would be protected by the right to have an early evaluation stay, because the prerequisite for getting that early evaluation state court is to have done a CASP report. And most businesses haven't taken advantage of that. So I just really don't think that it's the legislature's procedures that are really having an impact on why people file in federal versus state court. It could be also that the state courts are more impacted and that justice is faster in the federal courts. But I have no data to back that one up.
Thank you. Anyone else want to weigh in on that question?
Yes, if I may. This is Dennis Price. I'm with Potter Handy. Our firm files the most cases in this area of law in the entire state of California. And so I think I'm fairly qualified to answer this question, at least as to our firm and as to a large number of the cases that are filed. We just prefer federal court. There's a lot of reasons, and it's almost completely irrelevant to the new procedures that have been put into place. As a practical matter, having a patchwork set of rules in every county, some of which have electronic filing and some of which don't, creates huge impediments to trying to keep track of cases. The PACER and ECF system is just leaps and bounds better than anything that exists in the state of California. This was something that Celia referred to, the underfunded court system. It takes us years to get a case to trial. It sometimes takes a year to get a motion to dismiss heard in the county of Los Angeles. So there's just, it's justice delayed is justice denied in the state courts. We get better continuity of rulings. The federal court system has all of their rulings that are available by Westlaw or LexisNexis. And so the judges tend to have more consistent rulings. That's better for our clients. That's better for justice. The fact that appellate practice is substantially easier in the federal courts influences us dramatically. We try to push new areas of law pretty frequently. And that very often requires getting the Department of Justice involved in any case that that we have to go up on appeal on an issue of law. And the Department of Justice, as a matter of policy, will not get involved in state court appeals, except for in very, very small circumstances. So if we're trying to push any sort of new case law, state court simply isn't useful to us. And then finally, even when we do file in state court, because we've, you know, for one reason or another decided we want to be there, a good 50-60% of the time, it'll get removed to federal court anyway. And so we might as well just start there, have everything continuous, and I'll have all of the benefits. I don't think there's anything the state courts can do short of actually funding the court system, or rather the legislature can do short of funding the court system to encourage people to go into state court, because it's just an inferior system from efficiency, from justice, from every point of view.
Thank you. And when you say you file the most cases in the state, how many cases do you file annually, roughly?
22 to 2,500.
A year?
Yes.
Okay. So let me follow up with you on the next question, because this gets at one of the other issues. So when all of these statutes got created, particularly SB 1186, somebody was concerned in the business community that there were these, they used a term I don't like to use, but you know, these high volume lawsuits, you know, and thought it was, someone coined it, a drive-by lawsuits, trying to say no one ever went there. They just go look in a car and then file all these lawsuits. And therefore they created a system by attorneys that are supposed to share a demand letter, which everybody sends out when they first start their case, and share it with CCADA and the state bar. Why is it that we're not getting the complaints when they're filed in federal court? From your perspective, are you not required to share your demand letter just because you're filing in federal court, but it still involves an ADA action in the state of California? And the reason I'm asking is because our numbers don't, your numbers alone, what you just quoted, don't seem to jibe with the numbers we're getting in terms of letters or complaints in the state. And so there seems to be a disconnect with why I don't understand what's happening in the state around.
Yeah, you cut out a little bit at the end, but I think I heard your question. We simply don't send demand letters. The procedure that's been put in place actively discourages it. It creates burdens on our clients. The Buchanan decision from the Supreme Court from early 2000s actively discourages us from getting remediation done prior to litigation. There's any number of reasons why we wouldn't want to bring a demand letter in these cases. But those procedural hurdles that Mr. Goldsmith brought up earlier absolutely have it. It's not just chilling; it's iced the demand letter entirely. And even in cases where we thought that it might be better for our clients in a vacuum to have a pre-litigation demand letter, we simply won't do it. We comply with the rest of the procedures. We notify when cases are opened. We notify them when they're closed. We don't have any problem with that. I suspect we have filed more of those than anybody else in the state, but we don't file demand letters, and that's why you don't have any from us.
So, and if I can follow up, thank you for sharing that, because it tells us something. Just because I wanted it happened, because it didn't mean that you had a letter, because actually what the issue was they were claiming that the demand letters, extortion letters asking for money. So it's, which we also know.
I'm losing, I'm getting, I don't know if it's on my end or yours, but I'm only hearing about half of what you're saying in your question.
Okay, let me slow down. Can you hear me now?
I am as well. Yeah, it's kind of in and out. Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I can answer the part that I heard.
I haven't asked a question.
Oh, okay. So go ahead. I apologize.
No. Please tell me if you can't hear me. What I'm saying is I'm kind of laughing because, you know, people have a certain narrative in the state around these cases. That's why SB 1186 was created. And what I'm hearing is you just simply said for those who were using it the right way as a remediation tool, to say, hey, I don't want to file this lawsuit against you, but here's what we got going on. And by the way, there is technically damages. So you do ask for a small amount of damages on behalf of your client. That whole piece is, you're saying, for people who are doing this kind of work regularly, and particularly your firm, which does many of the cases, is saying, then fine, we just won't do these letters. You're making it onerous for us to do that. Then fine, we'll just sue them. And therefore, there won't be any opportunity pre-litigation to resolve this, simply because you got it into your head that this was all about extortion. But for those people who were not just asking for money, but trying to get the access issue resolved, you've now tied their hands, so to speak, because they're not going to do all of that. They're just simply going to file the lawsuit. I'm paraphrasing, but is that in essence a fair statement?
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. These rules that were put into effect are good, or they're well motivated. There used to be in California some attorneys who were doing very unscrupulous things under the protection of the ADA and under UNRU. It motivated the reduced penalties that went in under 5556. It went into this high frequency litigant designation. Our firm is one of the unnamed two firms that bring some high percentage of the cases that is named in the preamble of that statute. And the premise that the HFL, the high frequency litigant designation, was intended to discourage vexatious litigation. And that was premised on the fact that there were these two firms that were filing all these cases, is just a well-baked in smear, basically. It's simply not true. The vast majority of these cases are based on well-founded violations of state and federal law. And for anybody who is trying to actually enforce those statutes rather than simply get dollars out of them, these procedures have put up hurdles that basically makes the cases more expensive. And unfortunately, some judges have also, jumped onto these rulings or these laws and have erected even more barriers. And the Central District, they have a procedure now of basically just sua sponte dismissing any state claims that get filed in federal court. So instead of reducing the number of cases that are filed, now very often you end up having two cases for every one filed in the Central District, because we have the ADA case going in the federal court, and then sometimes a parallel state case that gets filed after that in state court. I do think if there's any sort of changes that need to be made, some of the second and third order effects need to be strongly considered, because these procedures are really not hurting they're not really helping the situation and really only hurting the legitimate lawsuits.
Well, it's interesting. I appreciate your candid answer. It's interesting that you take the position as a plaintiff's counsel that there were in fact some scrupulous attorneys, and it seems to be that you said that rule weeded them out, but it also had another unintended consequence for some good lawyering that now doesn't happen in terms of pre-litigation. So, and the question I have, and I don't know there's an answer to it, but the rhetorical question begs, is that did you throw the baby out with the bathwater? Did you use a bludgeon in a very, you know, surgical piece? You know, you're a high frequency litigant, but it appears that you're doing everything appropriate. And since you're not doing demand letters, nobody can accuse you of extortion, as I often hear around the state for these demand letters that get sent asking for money. So how do we, if we don't have that pre-litigation process, isn't that just going to further the perception that the only cure for this is litigation? And I see Celia's hands up, but let me give someone else an opportunity to respond, and then we'll go back to you, Celia.
I'll let others respond. I think like you said, it's rhetorical.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, or anyone else, is there any other attorneys that want to chime in at this point? Go ahead, Celia. Hearing no one else, go back.
Thank you. I agree with everything that Dennis just said. And I would add that it's not just that it's difficult technically or procedurally difficult to file a demand letter. It actually, you have to report yourself to the state bar. And you're literally risking your bar card and your livelihood when you send one of these demand letters. And so it's the third rail. I can be the most diligent attorney in the world and be doing my best, but I don't want to take that risk. And so in a construction related access case, we very, 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 very rarely will send one. I don't even know if we actually have sent one since the new law came into effect. Now it only affects construction related access claims. It doesn't affect claims that are purely discrimination by policy. So we do sometimes make demands letters for pure policy cases, but nothing having to do with construction. And it's because the risk is so high, the statute's not well written, it's not been interpreted, and nobody wants to be the first one to find out how to do it wrong.
Understood. Thank you. Thank you, Celia. Is there any from the defense side that wants to weigh in about this issue?
This is Chris Vaughn.
Go ahead, Chris.
I think that from not so much from the defense standpoint as a question of how did we get to where we are? If I could just make a couple of comments about that to put it in context, and I don't know if this is going to lead to any solutions, but it might lead to some thinking about possible solutions. So in California, we obviously have the same requirements to comply with ADA as anyone else in the country. We have the statutory damages that are built into the ENRU Act, which basically says in California, thou shalt not discriminate, and then has a list of the lawyers call protected classes or age, race, gender, so on. The statute follows on then to say for each event or occurrence of discrimination, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, is a $4,000 statutory damage. And we then move through the history of the legislation, both 1186 and 268, I forget the first one, where some would say that what's needed is, if access is the objective, what's needed is an opportunity to cure access. Now, the other argument is, look, it's been 30 years and you haven't done anything, and I understand that. But if the objective is access, then notice and a chance to fix is one alternative approach. And I think the legislature recognized there were issues with this area of the law as it was being pursued and litigated, and they addressed that with the CAS program. They addressed it with the high frequency litigant designation with an increased fee in state court filing fee, as well as a early stay and early mediation or early neutral evaluation, I think is the term. And they addressed it by reducing statutory damages available in certain circumstances. If you had a CASP inspection and fixed it within a reasonable time after service lawsuit, if you're a small business defendant and you fix it within a certain time after service lawsuit, and if you have a CASP inspection and fix it within 120 days of that inspection, there's ways that the legislature reduced the damages. I'm not sure that it made any difference in terms of the litigation or litigation volume that those changes were made. The statistics suggest that in 2019, and these are kind of going from memory, so if they're not exactly right, I apologize for that. A little under, as I'll recall, 4,700 ADA lawsuits in 2019, and approximately 5,800 ADA lawsuits in California in 2020. And those are some statistics that are compiled by the national law firm Seyfarth & Shaw. So the trend in terms of litigation in California of disabled access issues is headed up. Now, one caveat, the estimate is that 20% or so of those are website cases, so they're not physical barrier cases, which are addressed by the Construction-Related Accessibility Claims Act. But I don't know that. I think from a defense standpoint, I don't know that the changes the legislature made has had any real effect whatsoever on reducing the number of cases that are brought. I'm not sure that there's been an effective addressing of those issues. And of course, that weighs, you know, against the right that this is a civil right. This is an important civil right. The concept of the damages being an incentive to comply, bring people into compliance, hasn't really worked. I think there's a genuine lack of information on the part of defendants, especially small defendants who may be immigrants or otherwise not well informed. So it's a matter to me of information on the one hand, because we routinely get comments from especially smaller defendants, mom and pop defendants, small business immigrant defendants, that, you know, we didn't know this was a law, or how could this be the law? Well, that's not a justification or an explanation for not complying. But I think that information is one issue, and then comprehension of what it really means is a second. And because there's no agency assigned to enforce this or to provide education about it, I think that's a piece that's missing here. I can't at the same time say that if information and knowing what was needed to be changed and how to change it would necessarily make people comply or encourage their compliance, it would certainly be a step. And you know, there are, it's not a surprise to anyone, I think, that there are some, what would we call them, recalcitrant defendants that say, when I get sued, I'll do something about it. And that's obviously not the attitude that you want in business community. You want them to be proactive and comply with this law, just like they comply with licensing laws, health and safety laws, and so on. But there is definitely a lack of information and a lack of awareness of what it is that needs to be done. And I think that impacts answers to what may improve access in California would include additional information and comprehension of what is actually required.
Thank you, Chris. We have about 10 minutes left, and I wanted to kind of bring a couple of things. We CCDA is trying to utilize the information so we can better help the state make better laws that put things into place and then make policy that's going to help improve access, as Anthony was talking about. I mean, it seems like we don't have the full level of participation with the case filing and resolutions database that we created. We are planning to have a follow-up meeting regarding questions on the online portal. And I hope some of you will participate as we seek to increase that that participation, because our information is going to be only as good as you inform us. And today I've heard some models that have come up in the state that you also think are better models that perhaps need to be replicated in state court, as a not just federal court. And I think that is really, really very helpful, because I think ultimately it seems like, given what it was shared today, it may mean that there may be some different legislative fixes to suggest to the legislature that maybe creates a system that you both agree works better for everyone involved and gets things to a certain level of completion. I heard both from the defense and the plaintiff side touting that process that gets you into dealing with the situation within 90 days. We know you can, in the current state system, you may be waiting, you know, a couple of years. So it certainly sounds like maybe if you all would be willing, we might be able to get a committee together of some of your participation to maybe make some recommendations to the legislature on some models that may work better in the state for everybody involved. Does that sound like something that would be helpful to everyone?
This is Chris Vaughn.
Yes, Chris.
I think we already have a system in place. It just doesn't work well, 58 different versions. Because there is already a stay, and I think it's called early neutral evaluation or some similar term. And it varies so greatly. I have handled a number of these cases in state court. And to my recollection, ever since that law became effective, there never been a judge involved in that process. There's a requirement that whoever does that process have some training, but it's like who forgot to step back or forward when everybody else stepped back. It's kind of like who gets stuck with that job. And in some of the counties, they don't even have a session. They just, and some of them, it was just a phone call even before the whole situation with COVID. So there's a system in place that simply doesn't work in our experience to have any meaningful impact on trying to resolve cases early in the state court system.
Thank you. I see some other hands. Anthony, Remy, Dennis.
This is Anthony Goldsmith again.
Can we start with Remy, because we haven't heard from her. And then Anthony, and then Dennis. Sorry.
Hi, Remy Tan. I'm a local San Francisco architect, and I just want to chime in. I've been working in California as a licensed architect for around 30 years, and since the beginning of ADA, and even under Title 24, which predated ADA. And one of the things with the law, it's fairly fair. If a business is having a change of use in the commercial space, or it's a new building or a significant renovation, that's when the ADA measures get put in. We've been complying with Title 24, and Title 24 and ADA is now kind of merged together, into one, one common requirement, and it used to be not that way in the early days, so it's a lot better now. But a lot of, I've heard, through other architects and other people in the planning building fields, that these lawsuits are filed against small businesses, and some of these businesses have been there years, there hasn't been a change of use, so they haven't had the triggers to bring their spaces up into compliance. And the issue that's happening is people are filing these lawsuits, and the cost of putting in two ADA restrooms, you know, it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars nowadays, especially in the Bay Area and Los Angeles, where construction costs are very high. So it forces these businesses to be in an uncomfortable situation that they actually have to close their shop because they can't afford it. So I'm wondering if the state, CCDA can create some kind of grant program that, businesses can apply for to bring the business, in compliance with ADA, without having, to find funding that may not exist or go out of business. Thank you.
Thanks, Remy. And we're going to pick up with the other piece in just a second, but let me briefly respond to that, Remy, which is, first of all, under the ADA, there is an exception. So the narrative that the poor small mom and pop businesses are going to go bankrupt is just not what the law says. That's just not the law. The law says if it's an undue financial burden, you can prove it. You don't have to do it. The other piece is we do have incentives in the state. They're not grants, but they are tax incentives. And we've had them for over 20 years. So part of it is we always can do better outreach. And I think one of the pieces that we also have to do is to better educate the community, because we constantly get this is the narrative we hear a lot, the small mom and pops, with which in actuality, most of the places that have to make the changes, there's already an analysis built in looking at their bottom line and overhead, if it is readily achievable, if it's something that they, that's not an undue financial burden. That was already taken up by the Congress when they did the ADA, because there was lots of feedback about that. But when we're talking about franchises and Jack in the Boxes and things like that, understand that small business is defined in our state by people who can make as much as $3 million a year. So that's not necessarily what I would call a mom and pop. So we also have these misnomers when we use the word small business, not understanding that it's a pretty big category. And so for those who are from poor communities, from language distinct communities, trying to do businesses, there needs to be more education there as well. Because it's not necessarily always an issue that you're going to go bankrupt. I think that's a good conversation to have. I think we could even have a whole symposium on the true mom and pop businesses and what really goes on with the ADA. Because I can tell you about some cases that I remember where it didn't cost money, they just didn't want to do it. And that had to do with aisles and a swap meet being widened, which wouldn't have cost any real money, but that caused a big problem. Anthony and Dennis, you were going to weigh in on the previous question because we're about to wrap up, and I wanted to hear from people about, do you think it would be helpful for us to look to having some uniformity on models that work better in the state through getting through these cases?
This is Anthony. So with respect to that exact question, the answer is absolutely yes. And Angela will certainly remember, and probably David, in my capacity in these legislative efforts, which was working with for Californians for Disability Rights, we have consistently advocated for the adoption of General Order 56 as a universal process. It really focuses things on access, and it is effective. My partner Celia already noted that our firm certainly finds it functional and really efficient. I do, however, have three specific pieces of legislative activity that might be entertained, and two of them have been brought up before, and here's a new one. One, we have consistently advocated from the disability community side for shifting some of the burden away from, let's not even use small business, micro businesses, real mom and pops, to commercial landlords. Under the theory that the commercial landlord putting a piece of property into commerce is in a substantially better place to understand, A, there are a number of laws and regulations that impact the ownership and leasing of commercial property, and more often than not, in a superior financial position. That was not accepted by the legislature, and for various reasons involving disinterest by certain parts of the business community. And what we got instead was something put into commercial leases, has there or has there not been a CASP inspection? And if so, you have to give it to them. So I think a greater protection and burden shifting to commercial landlords away from true mom and pop stores would not only create greater compliance, but would eliminate much of the hostility between two parties who should be naturally aligned, customers with disabilities and small business owners who would like to sell them things and goods and services. So that's one of them. Another idea that's practical, which we brought up before, is it didn't advance anywhere to even draft legislation, was with respect to parking lots, resurfacing, restriping and flat work and path to travel, that there is a certification from the contractor, which they have to attest to, that it is compliant and why, checking the boxes, a small form. I know this was discussed at the CCDA checklist committee, but it didn't take off from there. The idea is that you give people knowledge, because you have to do redo a parking lot every, I don't know how many years, it depends on the climate in California, but certainly several times since the ADA became enforceable. And if each of those times, you have to look at each of these issues and then give somebody a piece of paper, well, I decided just to blow it off. Then we'll find out exactly why there was a failure and why we still have a pretty shocking level of noncompliance. So that's another practical solution that the legislature could consider. But moving these lawsuits away from a conflict between micro businesses and adjusting that where at least I believe it should be towards the people putting, and I'm sure there are small mom and pop commercial landlords, but by and large, landlords are in a vastly superior position vis-a-vis micro business tenants. And that is a definition. I think it's in the government code. It's pretty small. And then finally, incentives, which was raised by Mr. Tan, and I think we have presented before. We tried to significantly increase the tax credit available under California law to, and that was advanced in, I don't think it was 1186. I forgot which bill it was. Unfortunately, Governor Brown didn't like that idea, but enhanced tax credits for barrier removal would be great, and something clearly the disability community I know supports. So those are three specific ideas that would get greater compliance without diminishing anyone's civil rights, and would get more information out to both the business community and micro tenant operators, micro business tenants would be a better way to phrase that. So those would be, and I think continuing this discussion on those and representing some of these to the legislature would be highly beneficial. Would love to participate in that.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? We have about 2 minutes.
This is Dennis Price.
Go ahead. You'll be the last word, Dennis.
Yeah, I'm happy to participate in any sort of these processes. I just do want to caution against more unfunded mandates in procedures in the courts. Those won't help us. That'll make it worse. Things like General Order 56 are good, but it's only good when there's actually a system in place to do it. But lastly, I just want to really challenge the premise of what's being done here. Reducing lawsuits in and of itself is not an admirable goal. Eliminating frivolous lawsuits is, but these lawsuits are being brought because it's a First Amendment protected activity to have your grievances heard in court. And we have state and federal rights that are being violated. If we want to reduce lawsuits, the only real good way to do that is to reduce the violations. Some of the ideas that Tony has proposed are good. There are a lot of other ones out there, but we really need to stop trying to put the procedural barriers in place under the premise that we're reducing lawsuits, because to the extent that you're successful, all you're doing is chilling civil rights enforcement. So we really need to shift that narrative to how do we make California more accessible, not less litigious. The litigiousness is actually good.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to turn it back over to Judge Sparrow if he would like to make any concluding comments. And then after that, I will hand this back over to our chair, Chris Downing. Thank you, attorneys, for I think a pretty enlightening conversation. Judge Sparrow, I'll turn it over to you.
So this was thank you all for this. This was really interesting for a judge to hear, for all of us to hear, I'm sure. I won't weigh in on any of the things that were said because I probably shouldn't, other than to say that all of these points of view have some legitimacy, it's great that you're all trying to come up with ideas that can get to, I would say both the underlying problem with regard to access and the consequences that may flow from that underlying problem, which is the use of resources in litigation. But I appreciate everybody's terrific efforts in that regard. I know many of you from litigations you've had before me, so I certainly won't comment on any of the substance, but I do appreciate all the hard work. So I'll turn it back to you.
Okay, this is Commissioner Downey. I'd like to thank all of the participants in that roundtable. It's a tremendous conversation, very helpful, and there's plenty of things for us to follow up on. And thank you, Commissioner Guilinus, for moderating this really wonderful panel. So thank you very much. So I did want to open it up just to see if there are any further comments from commissioners before we move on.
This is Commissioner L. Hessen.
Okay.
And, yes, thank you for this wonderful roundtable. It did bring to light more of what the Education Outreach Committee really needs to look at and focus in regards to compliance issue, both for small businesses and for local and state governments, whether it's public works or building and safety at the local cities when they're going out and approving parking lots in regards to access or in regards to architecture burial removal. So I look forward in coordinating a cohort and actually being able to address some of these issues as far as education and outreach to these stakeholders. Thank you.
This is Commissioner Dillard. I'd like to also ditto that. I agree 100% with the comment just made. I'd also like to just make comments on the panelists. I thought it was an excellent discussion. There were a number of items that were new to me, so I learned a lot as well. So whenever you're learning things, that's a good thing. So I appreciate the discussion.
Thank you, Commissioner Dillard. Any other commissioners?
This is Commissioner Leon Vasquez. So I am a small business owner. So a lot of this stuff was very enlightening and very just very eye-opening. I do have experience with the disability community prior to becoming a small business owner. So I was already aware of a lot of the in a broader sense, just the things that I should be looking out for. But I agree with everyone who was saying that education needs to be number one. If we're talking about the same small business narrative and a true small business owner, I just can't wait to get on that committee and just do some really great work and really spread the word. Because I know Dennis said, you know, the goal is not to reduce the amount of lawsuits, but I disagree. I think in educating small business owners, it will reduce the amount of lawsuits. And in turn, the end goal is to provide access to the disability community. And I mean, that should be the bottom line. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Commissioner Holloway. Just wanted to thank staff for putting this very good program together today. I think we heard from the right people, and I think the messages were helpful. And I look forward to pursuing this work as well.
Thank you. Any other comments from commissioners? Hearing none, Davina or staff, are there any comments from members of the public?
There's a comment, Commissioner Chair Downey, from Commissioner Allen. She said, this was a wonderful discussion to listen to. Thank you all so much. And there's also a hand from Accessible San Francisco.
Yes, am I unmuted?
Yes, you are.
Hi, my name is Will Railing. I'm calling on behalf of a small unincorporated nonprofit association, Accessible San Francisco. I appreciate the comment, the opportunity to comment. We are not involved with litigation in any way, so it wasn't appropriate for us to comment in the earlier part. I just want to put in a suggestion. One thing that California does excel at, across relative to any other state, essentially, is the robust availability of administrative adjudication of disputes. There's a huge core of administrative law judges that are used by so many different agencies. And we've been researching and exploring whether there's any way to provide, you know, administrative adjudication of UNRU Act and Disabled Person Act disputes where the disabled, the person with disability would not need a lawyer necessarily, and things could be resolved at much lower cost that's out there than anything out there right now. We're, you know, litigation benefits no one in the end. So the other thing I want us to raise was the CAS program. I really hope that Commission will continue its work to try to invigorate and expand the CAS program. I'm very concerned that the number of CASPs has sort of leveled off in the low 800s. Many of them are jurisdictional CASPs working for cities and counties, so they're not providing CAS reports to private businesses. Many other CASPs, I keep getting reports of this, are telling their clients, don't get a CAS report. I'll write you a letter stating your position to an agency or whatever you want to do, but don't get a CAS report. And I just think this needs to be addressed. And since the topic of tax credits were brought up, we'd love to see a tax credit for getting a CAS report. That would be a great start. Apparently, there are many, many businesses that are still not aware of their obligations, and that could be a way to address that. So lastly, since the building code has come in close alignment with the ADA, one of the potential administrative avenues for better accessibility compliance could be sort of reinvigorating the local enforcement of building code accessibility compliance. Now, you know, building code kicks in only when you're actually doing construction or an alteration. You know, there's no readily achievable outside of San Francisco's great accessible business entry entrance program. But, you know, how many businesses have not done an alteration or construction, you know, since 1982 when the first CBC accessibility standards kicked in? So that's just another thought. Obviously, we're full of some ideas, and we'll contact some of you offline to follow up on some of these. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments from members of the public? Hearing none, I think I would like to thank all our panelists on the roundtable today, and for staff and everyone's participation. I found it to be a tremendously helpful, informative discussion. So thanks for everybody's participation, comments, and good insights that were shared. So with that, I'll close out item 9 and move on to item 10. And I'd like to ask and see if any commissioners have any suggestions on agenda items for our next hearing, which is on July 28th, 2021.
Commissioner Parravanya, one of the things that has happened since we've been meeting remotely is there's been a significant staff turnover in the commission, and there are a very important part of our team, I think that we would all agree. I wonder if it would be possible at the meeting to have each staff member sort of introduce themselves to us and vice versa. We could talk about briefly about their history, what they do with the commission, and a bit about themselves as a person. I think that might be a good team building exercise.
Thank you, Commissioner Parravanya. I think that's a wonderful idea. So we'll take that into consideration. Any other suggestions of agenda topics for our July 28th meeting?
This is Commissioner L. Hessen. Yes. And I don't know if this is appropriate, so please correct me or if it should be directed in another platform. But I want to know how we can start proceeding on developing a cohort in regards to follow up on today's discussion and roundtable on expansion of our education outreach to stakeholders, specifically in relationship to compliance.
Okay. So noted. Any other agenda items? Okay, hearing none, I'd like to hear if there's a motion to adjourn.
This is Commissioner Holloway. I will move to adjourn, but I also wanted to compliment you, Chris, on running the meeting today. Really good job. It's difficult to run these Zoom style meetings. You can't see everybody, you know, you don't know who's necessarily talking if they don't announce who they are. And it's tough. And I just wanted to compliment you on running a really good meeting. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Compliments should go to staff and to having Guy Lemus chair that panel. I think staff throughout the meeting and Guy Lemus all did a tremendous job throughout all the agenda items and especially the roundtable.
This is Commissioner Jackson. I second the motion.
Let's hold the motion. I think Michael Parravanya, was your comment or a motion to adjourn?
I was going to second the motion and echo Commissioner Holloway's sentiment about the meeting.
Absolutely.
Okay, so then thank you very much. And I would like to then again ask for a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Oh, sorry.
Okay, I'll give it to Commissioner El Hassan. And then a second.
Commissioner Jackson, second.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Jackson. So all in favor? Say aye.
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 All opposed? Any abstentions? Terrific. This meeting is adjourned and look forward to meeting with everybody on July 28th.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take care, everyone.